The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 262, Modern Mormon Dissidents, The Manti Experience, Another Waco, by Becky Johns.
May I have your attention, please? We're happy to welcome all of you today to session 262 of the Sunstone Symposium. The title of this session is Modern Mormon Dissidents, The Manti Experience, Another Waco. And the format for this session will be that the scholar will present her paper during the first 35 minutes, followed by a 20-minute response from the second scholar. There will not be a question and answer period in this session. The scholar who is presenting the paper today is Becky Johns, who was an instructor at Weber State and a doctoral candidate at the U of U. She will be followed in her presentation by Martha Sontag Bradley, a co-editor of Dialogue, now teaching at the U of U, who studies the fundamentalists and the Branch Davidians, and is the author of a new book, Kidnapped from That Land, The Government Raids on the Polygamists, about Short Creek. We appreciate your attendance today, and we'll now proceed.
Can everybody hear me? Is that good? Let me know in the back. If you can't hear, wave a hand so I can speak louder. Before we start today, I thought it might be interesting to note how many individuals are here of whom I speak, because we have a large contingent of the Manti group here today. So all of you who are joining us from the Manti area, would you stand and wave so we can recognize you and send... Thank you for joining us today, and I hope you find it quite enjoyable. Undoubtedly, you have heard of those Mormons in Manti. If nothing else, you know something of them from the media in the late fall of 1992. There were reports told of several dozen Manti residents finding themselves at odds with the LDS Church over such issues as homeschooling, food storage, and temple rituals. These reports and rumors surrounding them fueled speculation of a Branch Davidian, singer-swap-style group of radical fundamentalists or survivalists who, according to some rumors, were preparing to storm the Manti Temple and barricade themselves there until the second coming of Christ. We Mormons are familiar with that fundamentalist fringe. After all, our history tells us of Short Creek, and we saw the bloody LeBaron all-red feud acted and reenacted on nationwide television. In almost every Mormon community are to be found a few fundamentalists, generally known for their practice of polygamy. Many believe it's only a matter of time before such a group again becomes militant. So what is going on in Manti? In the short time I have here today, I hope to answer that question at least in part. Let me begin by telling my position, which I think is important in telling the story. I'm neither an apologist nor a debunker. I'm not a member of the group. I'm an active LDS member and temple recommend holder with no fundamentalist leanings. I approach these people with genuine respect and interest, and that's how I hope to report about them. So who are they, and why are they in Manti of all places, and what are they doing there, and why have they been excommunicated? In addition to answering these questions, I also want to consider how this group of excommunicated Mormons juxtaposes itself with and against the mainstream LDS church. The mainstream church views these individuals as errant extremists who are unwilling to follow church authority and who have developed beliefs that are inimical to the mission of the church. An alternative view sees the LDS church as an unforgiving, autocratic parent who has expelled these once faithful sons and daughters, and perhaps not surprisingly, the offspring no longer desire to come home. They see themselves less as outcasts and more as liberated, free, and well rid of the encumbrances of a spiritual home, which they surmise too often sought to lead them away from God. So who are these Manti Mormons? Let me just make a brief comment here. When I talk about the Manti group, I am talking about a distinct group of believers who believe approximately the same doctrine. But in the Manti area, there are a number of groups. And I don't mean to suggest that the people there are monolithic somehow in their view or in their gathering. There are diverse groups. There are individuals who have fundamentalist beliefs who have not joined any group. And the group I speak of, which I will call the Manti group, is composed of about 400 individuals who have come together, but they are by no means the only group in that area. Demographically, there appear to be about the same number of males as females. Ages of adult participants run from about age 20 to 70. Economic status appears to be from about medium to low income. Occupations include professionals, nurses, construction workers, accountants, financial advisors, laborers, and housewives. Let me make a comment here that many of these people, almost all of them, moved into the San Pete County area when they had lived somewhere else and developed a life somewhere else. Consequently, they have skills and not very well suited to the rural farming area of Manti. So many of them who may have been highly skilled come into the area and must take much lower paying jobs. It was particularly interesting to me to find a number of families who have no visible means of support at all. One such man, when asked how he made a living there in Manti, as he held no job, replied that the Lord simply provided for him. He lived in a moderate rental home, did not seem destitute. He was not living off of his savings or retirement or investments or his family. In fact, he seemed to have no particular form of support. He reported this to me. "We go to the Lord, and the Lord tells me to spend $600. Well, I don't have it, so I procrastinate, you know. And I open the mail, and then there's the money. That's how it works. I'm driving up the road with less than $20 in my wallet, and a voice says, 'You have $300 in your wallet,' and the Spirit bears witness to that. Man, I pull that car over, I pop open my wallet, and I have less than $20 in it. It doesn't work like that. And I can hear the voices laughing. And then this little thing says to me, 'Inside pocket.' And I opened that up, and I pulled out three folded up $100 bills. And that's the way it works. I got down one time to where I had less than 3 cents. My son came up to us, and he said, 'You need to pay $10 the next morning for this college AP course for high school.' And I said, 'I don't have it.' And he said, 'Well, they're going to drop me in the morning,' and I go to the Lord. The next morning, I get out of bed and stand up, and I'm standing on a $10 bill." Unquote. Others told me similar stories. They also grow their own food, they live simply, and they help each other. They appear to be attempting to live a communal order. Let me make a comment here. I'm not suggesting these people are waiting around for the largesse of the Lord to simply drop money on their bedroom floors. They're hard workers. They do menial jobs in many cases to make ends meet, but they do rely upon the Lord when circumstances are such that they need to. Politically, some of the Manti group would be characterized as highly conservative, perhaps almost radically conservative. They're opposed to such a world order. Little evidence was seen, however, of traditional political involvement at the present time, although I must admit they have their own peculiar political viewpoint, which will be interesting to see how that plays out, but nothing in the traditional way of as we think of politics. Socially, they're a very close-knit community. They homeschool their children. Some have entered into polygamous marriages, and most are willing to accept polygamous practice. They believe in providing for themselves and derive a good deal of satisfaction from relating to those who think and act as they do. In terms of church activity, and I mean LDS mainstream church activity, they include former Relief Society and primary presidents, scout leaders, high councilmen, bishops, counselors, Sunday school and gospel doctrine teachers, always those gospel doctrine teachers, they get into trouble. The elders, quorum presidents, and the ward clerks, and others. They tend to have been active and in leadership roles in the LDS Church at one time, at some point in their lives. It would appear that the Manti group are much better scholars of Mormon scripture, history, and prophetic writings than the average LDS member. I tell people this. In fact, I told someone this just recently, and her comment to me was, well, there is, we should remember that we've been advised moderation in all things, apparently including the scriptures. These people share many characteristics with mainstream Mormons. They're honest, hardworking, and honestly seeking the will of God. They also share some characteristics with other fundamentalist groups: extreme conservatism, polygamous leanings, and fascination with early church history and writings. Significant differences are also apparent between the Manti group and other fundamentalist groups. Other groups have centered themselves around strong, charismatic leaders, and while they're committed to the first principles of Joseph Smith, and most often connected with the early Mormon church, plural marriage is the doctrine most fundamentalists find themselves identified with. The Manti group is largely leaderless, although this may be changing in the last few days, I understand, and has not sought to establish one individual or several at its head. However, it has been guided and led by what they call a high priest council. It has embraced plural marriage only after first embracing Smith's other early teachings and doctrines. The Manti group is also made up of individuals who were not born in polygamous families and who have not, for the most part, been involved with the practice before coming together in this group. As opposed to most members of other fundamentalist groups, the majority of Manti group members were active LDS saints at one time, and that usually was just a short time ago, having only been excommunicated recently. Another significant difference in the Manti group is that they see themselves more as a community rather than a religion or a group or a church. By that I mean they organize themselves in loosely coupled ways. The boundaries that would mark the group are fuzzy and permeable. This appears purposeful and differs from religious groups who carefully monitor who is in and who is out. And by this I do not mean that they have a flexible doctrine, because they do not. They have a very straightforward canon of beliefs. And in fact, they may be moving towards a more firm boundary in just the recent past. Do they constitute a cult? The word cult carries with it a lot of baggage. Cult madness, entailing all kinds of extreme behavior, are often associated with alternative religious groups. Although definitions of what a cult is may differ, the generally accepted understanding includes at least some of the following. 1, members are absolutely obedient to a supreme leader. 2, members are closely supervised by leaders and defection is refused. 3, the cult experience represents a radical break with a person's past. 4, cults discourage individual thinking and socially accepted views of reality. And 5, cults sever the members' ties with a larger society. None of these seems to apply particularly to the Manti group. They do separate themselves from the mainstream church, although the church has also cast them off. But I would not characterize their separatism as cutting off ties or a radical break, especially with the community and with their family members. I do not see these people as violent, and I saw no evidence of violent tendencies. However, I do see a milieu of violent propensities in the community and surrounding this group, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. Why were they excommunicated? Not all, by the way, have been excommunicated, but many have. A memo, the authorship of which now is in dispute, was allegedly circulated to stake precedence over the signature of Malcolm S. Jepson, area president in the Manti area, enumerating a number of activities for which members were to be watched, counseled, and or disciplined. The list included such things as excessive food storage, homeschooling, the use of temple rituals outside of the temple, excessive political activism such as support of arch-conservative Bo Grites. Members who were found to be engaging in these activities were to be called in by their bishops and stake presidents and urged to cease these activities. Following the Brethren's counsel and ceasing these activities proved to be impossible for these saints. Some were disfellowshipped, Some were told no longer to associate with certain individuals, many of whom were their neighbors and friends, and others were excommunicated. From those experiences related and excommunication letters available, the following appear to be the most frequent official reasons for excommunication: refusal to obey the council of file leaders, conduct contrary to the laws and order of the church, being out of harmony with the church, for continuing to associate with apostates when counseled to do otherwise, and simply for apostasy. The disciplinary councils and events leading up to them are interesting stories in and of themselves, and some of these will be published by the Mormon Alliance in the coming months. However, because of the rumor and innuendo of violence surrounding these events, it seems necessary to recount some of the background and subsequent events relating to them. The local sheriff, the state police, the FBI, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the Internal Revenue Service, and the state police were anonymously warned that certain people in Manti were arming themselves, were dangerous, and were radical fundamentalists. Apparently, several of these agencies have conducted investigations, including interviews of group members and their neighbors. The agencies are unwilling to divulge information regarding these investigations outside of the Department of Public Safety, who has been forthcoming in recognizing that an investigation took place and in suggesting he was satisfied with what he found. Group members further allege that their phones have been tapped or monitored, that their mail was opened prior to delivery, and that overnight priority mail was held at the post office and not delivered until specifically requested. This may sound conspiratorial, but it should be borne in mind that this is a small, isolated town, and it's impossible to separate church from state from neighbor because the same people fill all three positions. One couple reported that when they first came to Manti, they found a home they liked and they sought to rent it. They were accepted, paid the monies, and only to have the money returned several days later and told the house was unavailable. When confronted, the landlord said, "We don't want your kind here." Others told about harassment at church and about former ward members and absent family members being called by church officials and warned not to have further contact with group members. Other group members are positive that their homes have been watched more closely by police and that their neighbors monitor their comings and goings. Group members allege that they have suffered some abuse, harassment, and have been treated in unchristlike fashion. To further understand this Manti group, it's necessary to examine some of their beliefs and philosophy. After careful reading of the transcripts of the interviews I conducted, there seemed to be three central themes in their discourse. Number one was separation from other people, from popular culture, from the mainstream Utah LDS church, and gathering to a particular place, a sacred place, Manti, Utah. Two, restoration, restoring or reclaiming of the first or primary principles in early Mormon scripture, ideas, and prophets. This restoration includes a fascination or perhaps fixation on the idealized past, particularly the teachings of Joseph Smith. And three, the elimination of separation between the ordinary and the extraordinary, or the secular and the divine, including miracles, visitations, answers to prayers, and divine interventions as expected everyday occurrences. Regarding the first theme of separation, the Manti group share some beliefs with other dispensational premillennialists. This idea of separation is one of them. Both groups see the world as evil, corrupted, separate from God. Essentially, people have turned away from God and embraced Satan or his ways. Human beings by themselves are unwilling or unable to correct this problem. They require divine intervention, even divine rescue. They see themselves and others living in the very jaws of hell and within grasp of overpowering evil. They are snatched away from these jaws only by the extraordinary intervention of God. For most premillennialists, this rescue is scheduled to happen at the second coming of Christ. For the Manti group, this intervention is happening now, and they participate in an ongoing, everyday interaction with God through the veil, which provides them, quote, further light and knowledge, and provides the means to live in the world while not being of the world. They believed it best to separate themselves from the world as much as possible because the world is corrupt, and continued association with it is corrupting. The Manti group carries this idea of separation even further by strongly denouncing the mainstream LDS church as a source of evil and corruption and therefore seek to separate themselves from it. One adherent talks about coming to the place of Manti when he says, "One of our friend's daughters was getting sealed in the Manti temple, and we came to witness that. And as we came, the Spirit bore witness to us in an incredible way that we needed to be in Manti. And I mean, it was incredible. We went back home, I sold my business, I sold my house, and in 3 weeks I was living in Manti. That was 13, almost 14 years ago. I came here because the Lord called me to come here. He wanted me to come." So separation to a particular place, to Manti. Others related being told to come to Manti, of being led there, and of having visions or dreams or testimonies that they should be in Manti. Very few of these people lived in Manti all of their lives. Almost all of them were outside of the area. Many said they felt that they were being prepared by the Lord to do a great work in Manti before they ever became acquainted with the members of the Manti group. When speaking about sacred place, Eliade posits that religious persons create or discover places which are holy in order to place themselves as near to heaven or God as possible. Literally and figuratively, a high place. The purpose of this placement is to convene with the divine. The Manti group describes their experience as making a connection to heaven, and they see themselves as foreordained to accomplish that goal. One person says, quote, "Orson says," meaning Orson Pratt, "that we shan't get these people on the Wasatch Front to live this stuff," meaning the gospel. "The day will come when they will have to leave and go out into the mountains roundabout and start anew. Well, at first we never thought of that. We didn't even know about it. And here God sends a bunch of people out into the San Pete Valley. They just begin to collect together, and they begin to realize what's going on. These are the last days. These people are gathered here by the Lord, and they know the Lord." Unquote. This sense of divine purpose was ever present in these interviews. These people find in the city of Manti and the surrounding areas a place to enact this purpose. The Manti Temple also appears to play a prominent role in the sacred place of Manti. We'll come back to that in just a minute. Regarding the second theme of restoration, Jam Shipps has characterized Mormonism as radical restoration. Early Mormons sought to capture those precious original ideas, ordinances, and structures of early Christendom, which Shipps points out was a kind of restoration itself. The Reformation was not sufficient. A radical break with all institutional understandings of religion was necessary to return to the pureness of the gospel as Christ taught it. The Manti group contends that the LDS Church has lost its restoration spirit. In fact, lost it almost immediately and began to corrupt and change the very precious truths it sought to restore. It's ironic that the mainstream Mormon church, once perceived so radical and peculiar, now looks with disdain upon those in its midst who cry for extreme radical measures. One way to view this difference is to understand it as a difference in degree of process. The mainstream church sees the restoration as complete and finished, whereas the Manti group views the restoration as a continuing process, one which has not been completed to this day. In examining the Manti group in regards to restoration, it may be worthwhile to break this down into several issues. One is the prominence of Joseph Smith and his place in the church today. Two is the issue of personal revelation, and three, the importance of temples. Persons interviewed testified many times that Joseph Smith restored the true gospel to the earth, that he still holds the keys to this dispensation, and that his view of the gospel has been distorted and ignored by subsequent prophets and leaders. The extent of the importance and reality of Smith to the Manti group is seen in this quote. "I was giving a blessing to a man one night. Right in the middle of the blessing, a voice said, 'I am here.' I've learned not to be shocked at this kind of thing, and so in my mind, as I talked there, I just simply started speaking to him. And the voice returns, 'I am the prophet Joseph Smith, and I am here observing and approve of what you're doing.' And boy, I guess the witness of the Spirit nearly dropped me on the floor. We've had those kinds of experiences regularly, and it's only because the people are willing to listen and use the keys." Unquote. The Manti group goes beyond mainstream Mormons in their interest in Joseph Smith. They look deeply and continually into his writings and find particular significance in the activities and writings of the last 2 years of his life. This kind of emphasis is radically restorative in seeking to replace Joseph Smith to the place of the preeminent prophet, where they believe he still belongs today. One interviewee said, "Joseph Smith is a true prophet of God and stands even now on the other side of the veil, directing us as the head of this last dispensation." Personal revelation appears to be a cornerstone of how the Manti group seeks out the things they wish to know of God, but personal revelation also seems to be the standard or ensign of the group as well. In a now relatively widely known letter directed to the stake presidents of the Manti, Moroni, and Mount Pleasant stakes, 27 of the excommunicated Mormons in Manti testified of their unswerving devotion to the principle of personal revelation. They said, "We have been taught that modern revelation is what separates us from the rest of Christianity, not only because we have a prophet who receives it, but because it is the privilege and responsibility of every member to obtain it as well." End quote. When confronted by bishops and stake presidents about their nonconformity, the Manti group almost uniformly defended their actions by reference to their own interpretations of truth, as discovered often through prayer and personal revelation. As personal revelation continues to be a central doctrine of the mainstream church, church leaders undoubtedly found themselves in difficult circumstances when it became necessary to claim obedience to the Lord's anointed leaders to be a higher truth than personal revelation. The Manti group is not at all reluctant to grant a higher truth to the Lord's prophet in receiving revelation for the church, but they are extremely reluctant to do the same for revelation received for their individual lives. In other words, they did not feel, nor do they feel now, that they must follow the brethren when their own personal revelation is contrary to what the brethren tell them. This produced the major confrontation between the church and Manti group members, and was the reason many of them were excommunicated. Here one of these situations is recounted. "So, the stake president interviewed us, and he said, 'I counsel you as your stake president to stop doing that,' praying in the true order of prayer outside of the temple. 'And if you won't stop, then you stand in jeopardy of disciplinary action.' I said, 'Well, I appreciate your counsel, but I cannot follow it.' And so it was a little while after that that he interviewed us again. He says, 'Well, have you stopped?' I said, 'No.' He said, 'Then you are disobeying counsel. You are not following the counsel of your presiding brethren.' And I said, 'Correct. If your counsel is contrary to the counsel that God gives me, I will not follow it.' So then they held a court and they excommunicated us, not so much that we prayed in the true order of prayer, but that we would not follow their counsel." Unquote. Personal revelation is tied to notions of freedom, conscience, and self-determination, which are some of the most closely held beliefs and values of most Mormons, and particularly of those groups of people in or out of the church with fundamentalist leanings. It seems little wonder that the doctrine of personal revelation became a flashpoint of contention. Temple and temple rights are also a primary concern to this Manti group. Much speculation and rumor has surrounded the Manti temple and the group's association with it. Recently, a friend of mine visited the temple, and when they got to the celestial room, they were told to exit immediately and not linger there. Certainly do not ponder or pray, because someone in the Manti area had been performing illicit plural marriages and second anointings in the celestial room, and they were trying to prevent anything like that happening during the sessions. It appears that the temple is indeed a contested site in Manti, with those who hold legitimate authority feeling threatened by those who are prohibited from entering it. The sense of restoration and temple ritual is especially strong in the Manti group. Also strong is a restorative vein in the expanded practice by the Manti group of the true order of prayer. The group has explained their beliefs about the true order of prayer in the following way. Quote, "We bear testimony that these keys work, that the heavens are opened and the answers are clear, that spiritual experiences abound and far surpass anything else we have known. This is mighty prayer, and we testify that we know from many sacred experiences that this is indeed the way the Lord has ordained for those who have been endowed in his holy temples to come to him and communicate with him. It has been taught in these temples for over 150 years, so that those who are endowed may use it in their own personal temples, their homes, to receive their own personal revelation." Once this practice became apparent, these people were asked to cease praying in this way outside the temple. I heard several stories of how this disagreement about this practice was the catalyst for excommunication. It is obviously a closely held ritual, meaningful and powerful to these people, and one which they will not give up in exchange for membership in the church. One individual related some interviews he and his wife participated in with their stake president and his counselors regarding changes in the temple ceremony and the prohibition against prayer circles. As mentioned before, many of these group members are extremely familiar with early church writings, and this individual was using the words of Joseph Smith and other early church leaders to defend their contention that the ordinances and rituals performed in the temple were to be unchanged. The stake president, who was interviewing them at the time, responded by saying, "Well, after all, those are all dead prophets, and their words are certainly not as important as the living prophet." He said he wanted to turn instead to Scripture, to the Book of Mormon, for answers to these questions. The interviewee responded by asking, "But aren't those dead prophets too?" And that effectively ended that interview. This points out the difficulty both parties have in dealing with doctrine, which changes over time and often contradicts itself depending upon whose version of it you are examining. This represents some of the ways the Manti group has defined themselves in regard to restoration. Restoration of the place of Joseph Smith, restoration of the original meaning of the doctrine of personal revelation, and restoration of early temple and priesthood ways and understandings. These restorations are important and central to the way that the Manti group understands themselves and their relationship with God. The last theme I want to examine in the religious discourse is the idea that there is for them no separation between the ordinary and the extraordinary, or the profane and the divine. Much more than for the average Mormon, this Manti group seems to experience God in their everyday lives. They see visions and dreams, hear voices, see angels and messengers, witness miracles, cast out Satan, and seem to expect these occurrences in connection to living their lives in accordance with the principles which we've already discussed. A friend and associate describes these experiences, quote, "Put quite simply, they are receiving messengers. There have been angels who have appeared in response to being summoned. Some of these angels have bestowed blessings. Others have provided further light and knowledge, and others further direction from the Lord. There have been sentinels dressed in full armor who have protected various members as they have performed the callings they have received from the Lord. There have been concourses of angels seen and heard who were singing to the Lord as various of the saints have done the Lord's bidding." One man described a personal experience. "Our child was born 2 months premature. We witnessed her spirit leave her body. We witnessed her die, her spirit leave and return to her body after being commanded by the priesthood which I held. We've witnessed miracles. We've seen them. There were angels present that morning when our daughter was born. I cannot deny these things." Unquote. If God is more real to these individuals, well, Satan is just as real. And some Manti group members relate having seen and dealt with him. After coming home one night from a group meeting, we had to deal with the adversary. We had to cast him out, and the Lord opened up the heavens, and I saw the evil spirits trying to get back into our house because for such a long time they were very comfortable there. They started doing some things to our children. My son Tyler was picked up out of his bed and held up about 4 feet out of his bed and then dropped onto his bed. Tyler used to come to us. In fact, one night he came to us and said, "There's somebody in my room, up in the right corner of my room that will not leave." And so I had to go in and use the keys of the priesthood to cast him out and give my children blessings. We began to use the priesthood in our home for protection against the adversary. I can still see the shadow of Satan standing in the doorway when I commanded him to leave, and he left, but he was very reluctant in wanting to go. Unquote. Thanks. Some of these stories are more or less dramatic, but I think you get the idea. I only have a minute left, so let me conclude. Hence these themes, separatism, restoration, and direct continuing interaction with the divine, seem to be pervasive in the lives of these people. These elements combine to make this group an unusual and interesting group of schismatic Mormons. But there have been other schismatic groups, over 130 of them, according to the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, and they didn't last more than a few years. So what's the potential for this group? And more importantly, perhaps for us, is there a potential for another Waco disaster? I see several elements which lead to potential violence in the Manti group and the Manti group area. First of all, there's an incredible influx of individuals to Manti. The population of Manti has doubled in the last 3 years, and this population is not supported by industry or housing. That kind of influx bothers people, concerns them, gets them angry and upset. Secondly, we have a long tradition, as I said before, of some particularly nasty fundamentalist groups becoming involved in violence. We also have separatism as a precursor to violence in many situations. Think of Jim Jones separating from the U.S. and going to Ghana. There is also the contested site of the Manti Temple, and that whenever there is a contested site, there can be some contention. Also, we have already the involvement of the FBI, the state police, the ATF. These kinds of involvements have in the past precipitated violence themselves. We also have had an incident there recently in Manti concerning the theft of some arms, some weapons, some guns and ammunition, which made the community extremely nervous. Rumors were rampant that the group had stolen the guns and were going to shoot the Angel Moroni during the Manti pageant. So there was an incredible amount of anxiety going on. There have been death threats. There is the fear of the unknown, what's going to happen with these people in our midst. All of these things lead to a conclusion that there is a potential for violence here. We must be incredibly sensitive to the elements which might produce violence. And I think that it's altogether possible. What's going to happen in Manti, I'm not sure. I'd like to call these people Mormons. Psychological distance is created by describing others as different. Those things which are familiar are called ritual, but those things which are different are called bizarre. Different religious observances become aberrant behavior, and persuasion becomes propaganda, zeal, militancy, religion, occult. Aberrant, zealous, occult, these words were used to describe Mormonism and now are applied to those individuals which Mormonism seeks to define as other. Some religious scholars like Catherine Albanese recognize the importance of differentiating this other for religious persons because it marks the boundary of the religious community. Naming and denouncing what is other keeps the center firm and safe. All groups define themselves by boundaries, by identifying those people who are in and those who are out. Group members who are in have a vested interest in constructing the definitions of in and out and of deciding where the boundaries are laid. Those individuals defined to be out are continually contesting those boundaries, and they do this by battling about what is right or wrong, what should or shouldn't be, and what is or isn't. Those are the border wars. Significant doctrinal and organizational issues are examined, debated in religions because those who sit on the boundaries force that debate. And they force those in the center to re-examine, reinvestigate, and reconstitute their images of themselves. These border wars and the individuals on the outside who do battle there serve the religious group, the mainstream church, by helping the religious group to define itself. The price paid for this service is personal. The result of naming the other is often dehumanization and abuse. It is a way to deny individuals their fully human status. Calling the Manti group and others like them by names like extreme, brainwashed, bizarre, subversive, dangerous, and even insane or at least unwholesome strips these individuals of their humanness and their uniqueness. It serves to distance one from another. For me, this investigation has been more than just an analysis of a few individual stories in an obscure area in Utah. It gave me an opportunity to reflect on what it means to be a Mormon, and perhaps what it means to be human. In light of this reflection, I've come to see the otherness of the Manti Mormons and other disenfranchised religious persons as less other and more familiar, and that has been satisfying. It has also helped me to see my religion in a different way. I have seen some of its magic and mystery unknown or forgotten by me. And I ask myself, has my extraordinary religion been made ordinary? Have I lost the understanding or the ability to see the divine in the profane world? I believe I can see what Albanese calls cultural contraction in Mormonism. Oh, I forgot to tell you about that. I believe I understand more about the restoration and restoration processes, and I've also been saddened and angered by the alleged injustices which have been related. Mostly, I learned about individuals, about people struggling by themselves and as a community to find their own way to God, to understand and act in ways which empower them. I wish them God's blessing in their own endeavors, and hope we, as a people who share common heritage and common goals, can learn from one another and can learn to live with one another.
I really like Becky's use of the term border wars. I wish I had said that. I think it's just perfect description of all of this. On December 15th, 1890, a few days before the Wounded Knee Massacre, Sitting Bull, the mystic leader of the Yucapa band of the Sioux Indians, died in a shabby scuffle at his cabin door near Fort Yates, North Dakota. A detachment of 43 Indian police, backed by an Army cavalry unit, had come to arrest him, backed by the Army cavalry logic, the bureaucratic logic, or institutional logic, that the ghost dance posed a substantial threat to the security of the American people. The ghost dance cult, a highly Christianized millennial movement, was led by a charismatic Paiute from Nevada named Wovoka. Wovoka identified himself with Christ, returned this time as an Indian to renew the world. His followers, the ghost dancers, would be the only people spared as a cataclysm rolled over the land. They would inherit a country filled with wild game and cleansed of greedy settlers, missionaries, soldiers, and gold miners. Earlier that year, 11 Sioux men had left their reservations in the Dakotas, taken the train to Nevada, heard Wovoka's message, and learned that the ghost dance, so-called because of Wovoka's followers, believed that their relatives were killed in battle with soldiers and would soon be reborn after the great cleansing that was about to happen. The new movement spread rapidly in the Dakotas and elsewhere in the West. Sitting Bull, whose prestige remained high no matter how much the federal government tried to ignore or belittle him, asked one of the 11, Kicking Bull, to tell him about it. While not joining the movement himself, Sitting Bull listened to what they had to say and gave it his tacit approval. Perhaps he could not realistically have done otherwise. He rightly feared that the Indian Bureau and the Army would not like the ghost dance, but Kicking Bull told him that when Wovoka's followers wore their ghost shirts, which were long muslin shirts painted with mystic symbols, the soldiers' bullets could not harm them. The ghost dance was entirely nonviolent and pacifistic, but its sudden spread in the later months of 1890 baffled Indian agents and military commanders. On the Sioux reservations up and down the Missouri River in the Dakotas, the Indians clearly were up to no good, and since Sitting Bull retained his spiritual leadership, clearly he was behind it. Sitting Bull, therefore, had to be arrested. Ignorance produced fear. Fear produced a violent reprisal. A century has passed since Sitting Bull's death, and you know the longer story of it. But during that 100 years, we have not yet benefited from history's lessons. The pattern of the church's dealing with the Manti Mormon, what they call troublemakers, is strikingly similar. This group, for whatever reason, and I think Becky has very clearly defined the boundaries between us and them, separated themselves from the larger society of Mormonism. They are the wild Indians of our time. They are being treated like Sitting Bull. And the church's approach to dealing with them was institutional, bureaucratic, in the effort to purify or to homogenize the center. Our myth of oneness for men like those who directed the excommunications seemed to justify this effort at the equivalent of maintaining national security, preservation of who we are, as they define it, by eliminating those we know we do not want to become. But here lies the greatest danger. Our desire for superficial unity creates the church's policy of distrusting all loyalties other than to itself. Let members generally accede to the church's goals and programs, and they will flourish. If they run crossways to them, however innocently or even however intentionally, they will find, like Antigone, that they have committed the crime of piety. Politically, there are also several precedents to this type of activity. Consider the long and arduous, tortuous history of conscientious objection and of the repeated trials over whether or not Jehovah's Witnesses should be forced in public schools to salute the American flag or to say the Pledge of Allegiance, and there are hundreds of such cases. And for every Justice Jackson, who was one of the judges who ruled in one of those cases, affirming that, quote, no official, high or petty, can prescribe what should be orthodox in politics, nationalism, or religion, or matters of opinion, unquote, there is another zoning board, school principal, or senator all too willing to determine those things for us. There is something very foul at work here when we allow our zoning boards, or our local high councils, if you will, to define orthodoxy for us, to adjudicate our lives in the church, so arbitrarily, not in the political world according to the rule of law, but by the rule of will or the rule of men. I suppose I should admit to you that I'm profoundly and fundamentally opposed to the church's judicial system. I do not see any justification for it. And I'm reminded of a number of years ago when I was asked to comment on a paper about the dream mind, and I basically don't believe in dream analysis. And so, again, it's a sort of weird choice of commentators. But I have studied the fundamentalists, and I have studied the Branch Davidians, and I do not consider either group to form a danger to the social, religious, spiritual security of the American people. I believe Christ's way was patient, long-suffering, forgiving, offering ultimate mercy, and church courts are not, under any circumstances, courts of love, which offer what Christ offered to all of us. They cause havoc in the lives of those most confused and perhaps most suffering individuals who need compassion and perhaps guidance, but not what results from a court. This week, a local stake held a special stake conference to deal with an embarrassing episode in the life of their stake president, a very public sexual indiscretion that undoubtedly caused his family and loved ones incredible pain and suffering. In that conference, his ecclesiastical leaders showed him remarkable compassion and forgiveness, saying that his actions would not affect his eternal salvation or his wife's, but that because we are a church family, we need to offer forgiveness, we need to offer mercy instead of judgment. And I am glad for that. I was offended by how readily many laughed at his misfortune. But my heart bleeds for other excommunicants who sat in that audience, for whom mercy had not been offered, who had not been included in that metaphorical family of the church, whose lives and whose children's lives will never be the same because of the harsh treatment they have received at the hands of the church. It seems easy for many of our leaders to use the metaphor of the family as if all of us understand the family in the same way. But my sense of what a family is that once you're in, you can't get out. And as Robert Frost said, your home is where they have to take you in. I would hope that our church would become a sanctuary and would be the one safe place where all of us could stay and be and flourish. And when we are tired and discouraged or in need of help, or when we are confused and we have failed at what we need to do, we are still welcome. I think the most problematic element of this paper, and perhaps any description of these excommunications as an event with understandable boundaries, is in any definition of these people as a group. I believe that they are not a cult, as Becky said, nor a new religious movement, for they are very diverse and eclectic in their belief and behavior. They are uniformly defined only by their excommunications, by their being targeted by the church for discipline. The church has given them a reason for considering themselves a group. There is among them an incredible diversity of supposed crimes. They are nonconformists. They dare to be different. They are perhaps extremists in some cases. They might be called Mormons with an attitude. Theirs were, like the Native Americans at Wounded Knee, crimes of piety. They are frequently overzealous. They carry church doctrines, in the opinion of their leaders, too far. They have tried to live what I would consider the 19th century church. They are a subculture of the larger group, at times quirky, but in my opinion never dangerous to either the moral or spiritual stability or reality of the central church. I am currently involved in research about Sanpete County for the state centennial, and I have found the earliest Mormon settlers of Manti to be very interesting. There we might have been able to create a very different model of activity, the active or typical or normal Mormon. Their names, the names of the 19th century Mormon saints, Manti saints, appear occasionally on church records or rolls. They float in and out of activity. Even the leaders have extended time periods when they are invisible to the written record. Yet they are there in the community. They're performing civic roles or they're acting as teachers or whatever. You know they're there, but they're, for some reason they float in and out of activity. If there had been an 1860 brand of acceptable Mormonism, homogenized Mormonism, that first generation of Sanpete settlers would never have cut it. Those settlers who at incredible odds fought Indians, nature, and frequently, far too frequently, each other to survive would not have conformed. They would not match the homogenized vision coming out of Salt Lake City. They were nonconformists. They were persnickety. They were ornery, perhaps. In thinking about this today, I think of my grandfather's face. You saw his stubborn nature on his overly sunburned face. It was that kind of rugged Mormon face that's born on a ranch, not in downtown Salt Lake City. He was not a businessman. He was not the kind of man that wore a suit. But that rugged individualism, that sort of quintessential American characteristic, flourished in the environment where he lived in Sanpete County. These characters, as their most recent counterparts, are far more colorful and interesting to study because of that. We used to, it seems, be more comfortable with diverse ways of being. Last summer, I heard a program on NPR, which was an interview with a botanist who specialized in reforestation projects, particularly for the chestnut tree. She told of a plague which had attacked the Connecticut woods, chestnut rot, which was killing chestnut trees by infiltrating the coarse bark and rotting out the central core. She was dismayed at this and said that she cried every time she walked through the woods, seeing hundreds of dying and decaying chestnut trees, which were her favorite, being taken over by the maples. Soon, she said, the chestnut trees will be a historical relic in the forest, and the forest will have lost some of their distinctive character. The interviewer said, but why does this matter if there are still lots of trees, still a densely populated forest? And the botanist said passionately that it is the diversity of the forest that makes it rich. It is not enough to have a large number of trees. Quantity is not what is important, but diversity. And here she moved from trees to people and back again. Diversity is what will save us, she said. Diversity of character, of ideas, of contribution, of people, of trees. Diversity is what builds us up and makes us strong. And I agree with her. I have also studied the Branch Davidians, and while I think comparing the Manti experience with Waco is probably an exaggeration, the heavy-handed treatment of both groups in both cases did not resolve problems but created new ones. And if I could return to the familial metaphor used for our relationships in the church. Recently, my brother-in-law kicked out his 14-year-old daughter because he said she was far too wild and disobedient to live with his other children. And my 11-year-old daughter was dismayed at that and came to me in tears and said, I don't understand this. How could a parent do this? And I told her, I have told you what I expect you to do, and I have told you what I believe you should do. But no matter what you choose to do, I will never give up on you. And I have thought that there are two basic types of parenting. The authoritarian parent who not only teaches but insists on conformity and compliance and rejects the child if the wrong choice is made. And the other kind of parent, which I would call the faithful parent, who teaches and then lets the child accept the consequences of their own behavior but always welcomes them home. Each technique can only be judged on the end result. If you kick your child out of your home because they have disobeyed the rules, however vile, you may have proved your point, but it's you who loses. You lose the child, which is the greatest of all gifts we have been given. For those of you children of God from Manti who have been bullied out of our church, you must know that there are many of us who grieve your loss. And I would like to conclude with a scripture that reminds us of this most basic Christian principle of long-suffering, charity, and accepting love and mercy. And these scriptures are found in Ezekiel chapter 34. And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say unto them, Thus saith the Lord God unto the shepherds, Woe be to the shepherds of Israel that do feed themselves. Should not the shepherds feed the flocks? Ye eat the fat, and ye clothe you with the wool. Ye kill them that are fed, but ye feed not the flock. The diseased have ye not strengthened, neither have ye healed that which was sick. Neither have ye bound up that which was broken. Neither have ye brought again that which was driven away. Neither have ye sought that which was lost, but with force and with cruelty have ye ruled them. For thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I, even I, will both search my sheep and seek them out. I will feed my flock, and I will cause them to lie down, saith the Lord God. I will seek that which was lost, and bring again that which was driven away, and will bind up that which was broken, and will strengthen that which was sick. And if I might, say this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
I'd like to thank all of you for coming today and to remind you that the taped versions of the sessions are available in the lobby. Thanks again for coming today.